Hi, everyone. We have a terrific interview with a man named Michael Bluejay, a funny, smart writer and former member of a philosophical cult in New York City called Aesthetic Realism. On next week's Jury Break, we're talking with Janja Lalik, a professor, author, and former member of the political cult Democratic Workers' Party. One note before we begin. In last week's Jury Break, Telltale Atheist and I mispronounced Stephen Hassan's name. I've seen his name in print a lot, but I never chatted with someone else about him, so I'm sorry. You'll hear me get schooled about that during this interview, actually. And I think that wraps this up. On to the interview. Today, we are speaking with Michael Bluejay, an accomplished writer, musician, philanthropist, and cyclist. He has a full and rich life despite being born into a cult and raised inside their cultic belief system until his teenage years. Michael, thank you for being here today and sharing your experience and unique outlook with us. To give us some background, can you tell us a little bit about the group that you were born into and your history inside?
Yes. It started in the 1940s in New York City by an acclaimed poet. And my grandparents were his contemporary, some of his first students. So that's how, my family was involved. You know, my grandparents were original founding members of the cult. And then so my mother and her sisters were born into it. And so I was born into it. It's funny, usually when I am asked this kind of question, I tell a lot about the cult and people say, well, you never told me what you believe. And I always forget that because to me, it's really the least important thing about any cult. I mean, if you read about various cults, they're pretty much all the same. The belief system is the only difference, and it's not what makes the cult a cult. What makes a cult is not what they believe; it's how fervently they believe it, and to the exclusion of everything else. Anyway, I'm not really answering your question though. So it's a philosophical cult. It's not a religious cult. You know, they have this idea about how the world works and how you should live your life, etc. And as I mentioned, I was born into it because my mother was born into it in New York City. And then when I was about 5 years old, my mom had divorced her cult husband, who they both remained in, though. And she met the man who would become my stepfather, and he saw that she was a brainwashed zombie and I was about to become one. And so he married her and took us to Texas to get us away from it, because unlike successful cults like Scientology, which are worldwide, the cult I was in, called Aesthetic Realism, has never made it out of Soho, New York. So they've been fairly unsuccessful in spreading in that regard. Getting us to Texas, of course, doesn't erase the bond. So my mother still remained a believer for about 10 years, at which point she had an epiphany and just, you know, woke up and, you know, renounced everything. And but even though in Texas, you know, she continued to practice, she started a study group of which I was a member. And then when I was 12 years old, you know, I went back to New York to visit family for a summer who they were still involved. And, you know, they brought me back to the group to have the therapy sessions and so forth. So it was on and off part of my life until my teen years.
Wow. I'm curious when you said that yours was or aesthetic realism was a philosophical cult and not a religious cult. Does that mean that members were free to believe in different or any deities they wanted?
Yes, 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 absolutely.
Interesting. And so it had more to do with sort of the regimented lifestyle that that aesthetic realism imposed on its members?
Yes, you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, you know, it's, you know, what, you know, most cults that make the news are religious cults. So those are the ones we hear about. You know, we hear about the compound in Waco. You know, we hear about various other cults that are, you know, deeply religious. But there are other things that, if not cults, certainly are cult-like. There are a lot of multi-level marketing organizations,
commercial cults, political financial cults, right?
They're political, exactly. I see you've done your reading. So, on the other hand, even though it wasn't religious, the members were so devoted to the founder and leader that it might as well have been a religion, with him being God. And former members have said that in exactly those words.
I'm so curious about cult leaders and the type of charisma or manipulation of which they're capable. Do you have any recollections of this acclaimed poet?
Well, yeah, I had at least one lesson with him when I was 2 years old. I remember I could identify him. If you read the transcript, which I have on my website, you know, when he walked in the room, I said, "That's Mr. Siegel." So, But he died in 1978, and I was 11 years old then, so I don't have a lot of memories of him. But he, you know, he was an acclaimed poet, and he was a literary figure, and he had the respect of his peers as a result, and so he wasn't as easily dismissed. You know, because he had that strength behind him. And also that's what attracted a lot of people to the group. They could study with, you know, the acclaimed Eli Segal. You know, and, you know, you hear the guy speak. He was, you know, he had a formidable mind, and that was attractive. And since he died, you know, they've been struggling because, well, they don't have the charismatic leader of the group. Like, there's no reason to join aesthetic realism anymore.
Right. Well, good news for all of us.
Yeah.
It actually reminds me a lot what you're saying about Scientology, because even though I won't necessarily get into the thorny subject of, you know, deities and Xenu, et cetera, within their belief system, but I do know that no one who is a Scientologist regards L. Ron Hubbard as God. There is this true, this allegiance to him. And I, you know, I've heard stories about children at these Scientology camps that have to look at L. Ron Hubbard while they're experiencing corporal punishment. People have to sort of, for lack of a better word, pledge to L. Ron Hubbard and thank you. And there are these portraits of him hung everywhere. It is a very deity-like status to which he's raised. So is that at all like Eli Segal, would you imagine or think or
well, remember? You're not going to believe this. And I blew my mind when I heard it, even as much as I knew about aesthetic realism. But a couple weeks ago, a former member told me that the idea is that when they were being intimate with their partners, instead of screaming out their partner's name, they were supposed to scream out Eli Segal's name.
Oh, no. That is such bad news.
Yeah. I haven't corroborated that, and, you know, I was young when I was in, so I didn't have that experience myself, but, you know, I like to say, you know, at this point, knowing as much as I do about the group, which I've been, you know, covering on and off for 15 years, that nothing surprises me, but that surprised me.
So, yeah, that is interesting. I haven't heard that about any cult. If you corroborate that, please let me know, because I'm intrigued.
My problem is I don't think a lot of people are going to want to go on the record about that, or even off the record. You know?
Fair enough. I don't blame them.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah. And neither do I. I mean, there's enough dirt on aesthetic realism that if we don't have that one, if we don't have that, you know, little tick mark to check, then I think we're still fine.
Did aesthetic realism, it really encourages members to be very conservative? In terms of dress
no.
and manner.
Oh, conservative dress. I thought you meant politically. Politically, they were extremely leftist. You know, the Eli Segal wrote books about, you know, anti-capitalist books about how capitalism was doomed to failure. How's that going? conservative dress. They were conservative in that aspect, but just because, I mean, the members tended to be, you know, they're professionals. A lot of them are accomplished poets, writers, musicians, architects, other professionals. You know, it's a group of New York City intellectuals, and they dress accordingly. Now, interestingly, there's another group that I had a passing familiarity with that was located outside of Austin for a while. It was a hippie farm called Zendik. They're no longer around. But I have a blurb on my website because, you know, having experience with both groups, they are so incredibly similar. And on the surface, you think, what is a group of dirty, unwashed hippies? And I say that with reverence because I used to be one, you know, not as part of Zendik, but, you know, just as an Earth Firster and, you know, an Austinite. But what does a group of dirty, unwashed hippies have in common with a group of New York City intellectuals? You would think they were worlds apart, but man, you read the biographies of the survivors and, you know, you just switch the names Aesthetic Realism and Zendik and they could be the same group.
That's fascinating. I really like that you brought up the fact that aesthetic realists were, it is this group of elite intellectuals. And so naturally, I'm sure everyone assumed they couldn't have been drawn into a cultic system. And something that you and I understand we're both passionate about is dispelling this myth that everyone who joins a cult is either weak or dim, not too bright or emotionally troubled. That's just untrue. And I wonder, firstly, have you ever encountered thoughts like this personally or professionally, you know, the stigma about cult recruits?
Well, sure. Everyone thinks that. Everyone who's not familiar with how cults work, that's a reasonable conclusion. I mean, you see on TV people who believe things. I mean, you know, the defining aspect of a cult is that, you know, the members are impervious to logic and reality. You know, they live in their own reality. So basically, they believe something that's not true. They have such a distorted worldview that it's ridiculous and it's obvious. You know, my kind of definition of, you know, being brainwashed is that the inability to see what is obvious to everybody else. And, you know, when you think about it, that definition kind of seems like the same definition of dumb or you're stupid. So it's a reasonable conclusion. But the thing is, the brainwashing techniques, they can work on anybody. You know, they can work on, you know, very educated, very intelligent people. You know, both my parents have master's degree. My mother's is from Columbia. Arnold Perry, one of the leaders of the group, he has a doctorate. I'm sure there are many others who do. Someone who was in a different cult, I was reading, you know, her biography, and she said after she got out of her group, she took an IQ test because she thought there must be something terribly wrong with her mind, you know, that she thought she must be terribly stupid to have been sucked in. And she found that she scored much higher than average. You know, and the psychologist told her, he said that this is not uncommon. You know, cult people are, you're often, you know, above average in that respect. And part of it is because since brainwashing techniques work on anyone, the cult wants people with powerful minds because they're going to be more committed. They're going to be better at recruiting other members. You know, they're going to be better members. I caution people to not just think, oh, well, you know, I would never believe that. Therefore, someone who believes something that ridiculous must be dumb. You know, once you get sucked in, it's a different story. And, you know, the pitch isn't, you know, when you hear them on the street and they're trying to recruit, you know, the pitch is not, hey, come join our group, devote your life to it, devote every waking minute of it, try to recruit your friends and family. If you can't, they're not your friends and family anymore. If that was the pitch, anybody would run away screaming. You know, that's not the pitch. You know, the way that you recruit is they say, hey, we're having like a poetry reading, or we're having a party, we're having some benign event that doesn't seem like, you know, it's any big deal to go to. So you go to, and, you know, maybe they'll have another one. And then slowly they start, you get involved deeper and deeper. And each step is so close to the previous one that you don't see that you're on a path. You know, and by the time you're sucked in, I mean, you're miles from where you started, but you don't really see it as that because, you know, they took you through one step at a time.
Right. And in fact, I'm going to back up everything you're just saying with some writings that you sent to me, because you did share some articles with me in advance of this interview. And so I'm going to share a passage from a Vice interview with Ian Hayworth. And for anyone listening, for the full article, please go to bit.ly/Hayworth interview. All lowercase, that's bit.ly/HAWORTH interview. And he says, the easiest people to recruit are ones with alert, questioning minds who want to debate issues with other people. You take a strong-willed, strong-minded person and put them into a cult environment, and the techniques used will break a person down very, very quickly. The smarter, the healthier the mind, the quicker and easier you are to control. It's just one of these tragic realities. That's Ian Hayworth, and that seems to align perfectly with what I'm hearing right now from you, Michael. And
yeah, it does. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yes, from the same article, he says, quote, common characteristics that emerge between members of various cults include a higher level of education, a weaker spiritual background, higher financial success, younger age, and fewer time constraints. So in other words, highly educated, non-religious, successful, young, dynamic people. These are the most susceptible to cult recruitment. And so it sounds like everything rings completely true for you via your personal experience and professional experience.
Pretty much. I mean, I can't go far as to say that more educated, more intelligent people are more likely to be recruited, but I can certainly say that higher education, higher intelligence is certainly no defense against getting sucked in and getting indoctrinated. You know, that I'll just you mentioned that interview was in Vice. So I want to give a shout out to Vice because they did one of the best articles or one of my favorite articles on aesthetic realism because it was titled "I Joined New York City's Most Boring Cult." So I'm very, very happy that came out a few years ago. And it's only new thing that's been written in a long time because, you know, the cult I was in is increasingly irrelevant since the leader died. And since they no longer have a, quote, cure for homosexuality, no one really pays attention to them anymore. That was their claim to fame. And since they don't do that anymore, they're, you know, uninteresting to most people.
Oh, got it. You got to go to Scientology for that now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there again, the groups are so similar. Like Scientology and aesthetic realism, they were both extremely anti-psychiatrist. You know, a lot of their values were very similar, even though they were completely different groups. One thing that kind of surprised me in that Vice interview that you quoted is I kind of like to think that the best defense about getting indoctrinated into cults is to understand about cults and understand how they work. Like I have an article on my website that explains exactly how people get recruited into cults. So if you read that and then you start to go through the same process, hopefully you can recognize, oh, wait a minute, this is that same process I read about on Michael Blue Jay's site. You know, Steve Hassan, who is, you know, was, you know, the former right hand man to the leader of the Moonies. He was the assistant to Reverend Moon in the 70s. And when he got out, he studied and now is probably the foremost cult survivor counselor in the world. He's contacted by the families who've lost their, you know, their kids to cults usually, or, you know, their, you know, the sister, brother, whatever. You know, usually he's not able to speak to those people while they're still in, but on occasion he is. And of course the challenge is trying to get them to wake up for the light bulb to come on. And it's, you know, even with everything he knows, it's still not easy. But one of the things he says is, you know, he shows them videos of people who were in cults and the kinds of things they say, like Heaven's Gate, which was a cult in the 90s, were in the California where they committed mass suicide. And before they did that, they all made videos about how they were going to some other dimension or something. And in the videos, you know, they're in the rows, the shaved heads, and, you know, they're the glassy-eyed stares, and they're saying, like, you know, I'm so excited about this, and you may think I'm crazy, but I'm not, you know, and clearly, you know, clearly there's something wrong with what they believe. And Hassan said that there's not a single current member of some other group who looks at that who doesn't say, yeah, that person is you know, that person's a cult, they're brainwashed. You know, they can recognize that people in other cults are in cults and are brainwashed. They can't recognize that about themselves yet, but sometimes being exposed to, you know, the kinds of things, you know, the similarities in the different cults, then they can start to make the connections. They can say, wait, this is exactly like the group that I'm in. You know, like, you know, I have this structured life, you know, this is, you know, I'm not allowed to question things, blah, 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 blah. Doesn't always work, but, you know, sometimes it does. Anyway, so in that Vice interview, Haworth was saying, you know, someone was asking him, you know, do you go into cults to research? He said, no, that would be very dangerous because I could, you know, I am at risk for being sucked in. And that kind of surprised me because I kind of like to think that, you know, as a cult survivor and someone who knows a lot about cults, that I could recognize the warning signs and I now have an immunization, you know, having been through it before, to getting sucked in. But he doesn't feel that about himself. And that's a strong testament to how much, you know, he believes that these brainwashing techniques are so powerful that they'll work on anyone, including someone who's been through it before.
Absolutely. Someone who's incredibly well-versed and a leading expert in the world can still be susceptible to these.
Yes. So the another similar thing is in the group I was in, there were two sisters, one in, one out. The one in, let's call her Mary. So her sister Rebecca, let's say Rebecca has a plan. She's going to infiltrate aesthetic realism to rescue Mary, and then they'll both walk out together. Well, Rebecca enters in order to, you know, pretend that she's, you know, believes everything and to rescue Mary. Rebecca gets indoctrinated and brainwashed and sucked in. For Mary, the light bulb comes on and she leaves by herself. Rebecca is still there to this day.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So even if you, before you go in, you know it's a cult, that may not last.
Oh, that is such a an uncomfortable
yes.
anecdote to sit with right now.
It is. It is. It's so much so. You know, there's another one. This high schooler, she had a blog and she had read my site. Someone passed on to me that she'd mentioned it. And she said, I just read the site. It was my website. And she said, now I'm terrified I'm going to get sucked into a cult. And at the time, I was thinking, well, if you've read that, especially if you read, you know, the how they recruit, you know, you're somewhat immunized. But now I'm wondering. I don't know. The article's on the website. It's, newyorkcult.com. And there's an article, how cults recruit. And it's not complicated. It's pretty simple, you know, but you won't necessarily recognize it because it's the one step thing. You know, there's that old story that a frog in a pot that's of lukewarm water that's slowly brought to boiling will never realize it. Will never hop out and burn to death. And that's probably a myth, but the concept is true. I mean, the concept as applied to, you know, cult recruitment is very true.
Oh, see, I always took that analogy literally. I thought that if you turned the heat up slowly enough, that eventually the frog would die without realizing it.
I think it's a legend. I think it is meant to be taken literally. But I think it's, even though it's meant to be taken literally, it's just not true. I think it's an urban legend.
Well, I guess we'll never know because I don't recommend anyone listening.
Yeah, yes.
Give that a try.
Empirically try to find out the veracity of that statement. Yeah.
The message stands true regardless.
Yes, absolutely.
And I agree with so much of what you just said. And you touched on something that I've given a lot of thought to, and that is from, by the way, is it Stephen Hassan or Stephen Hassan? Because I've said and heard Hassan. Okay, thank you.
I've met him, by the way.
Oh, you have?
Yeah.
Wow, I'm a big fan of his.
Yeah, and he has, most ex-cult people are interested in cults. And I believe he has counseled people who have left aesthetic realism.
Wow. That's incredible. I mean, his work is unparalleled. And I saw him in an interview on Leah Remini's Scientology in the Aftermath. And he touched on the subject of, you know, how someone asked, how do you get someone who's in a cult out of the cult? And
yeah.
He spoke to what you did, which is when you're in a cult, you may not be able to recognize the fact that you're in a cult, but you understand what a cult is. You can see cultic behaviors and warning signs and red flags about other cults. You can recognize the reality of other cults. And so
yes.
He recommends like bringing this information to the individual who's in a cult incrementally over time and saying, you know, talking about, for example, talking about or hearing a news segment about another cult and saying, oh, wow, that's weird. I mean, I'm just curious, in your group, are you allowed to talk to ex-members? And maybe just that's the only subject that day, you know what I mean? But it's about planting seeds and incrementally giving them information, because you can't confront, you know, with this overwhelming amount of truth, because people are, they have, the cult itself frequently has instilled these defense mechanisms within you.
Yeah.
Not to hear the truth or accept the truth.
Yes. Well, you know, if you can read and trust the media like most people do, then that's a problem for you when you start to read about your cult being criticized in the media. So one of the first things they do is to teach you to distrust the media. Does that ring any bells in the current political climate?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. You know, they forbid you talking to ex-members. Why? Well, you know, the light bulb came on for them. They could explain that. You know, ex-members, they're dangerous. So, mm-hmm. you know, they got to keep you away from them. You're taught that, people who have never joined the cult, they are just ignorant. You know, they have just not met truth and beauty yet. You know, there's hope for them. There's hope for them because they can still be introduced to it and then, you know, learn the beauties of whatever it is that your cult is preaching. But people who have left, they have intentionally turned their back on truth and beauty. They have relegated the rest of humanity to the sadness of not knowing whatever your particular cult believes. So they are the most evil, vile people in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting. I'm vegan. One of my best friends is an ex-vegan. Who then ran a website by and for ex-vegans called letthemeatmeat.com. And he's pursuing his doctorate at Oxford right now. But we continue to be friends, but what I like the best about a lot of the stuff he writes is that even as a vegan, I'm a vegan with cult experience. And there are absolutely cult aspects of extreme veganism, without a doubt. They're exactly the same as in aesthetic realism, as in Zendik, as in Scientology. And he had a piece on another website, I can't remember what it is, where the vegans are just lashing out at people who stop being vegan. The same way that the aesthetic realists hate the ex-aesthetic realists and, you know, the Scientologists and the Zendik, everybody. And it's the parallel is just so striking. So, I give him props for that because, you know, I think it can only, you know, as a vegan, it can only help veganism if the extremists wake up and see that what they're spouting is BS.
Right. Well, yeah.
Not about veganism, but about people who leave veganism, you know.
Right. I mean, right. The extremism there, because I eat mostly plant based myself, and a lot of the people I know do as well. And I think that's a great lifestyle. But we all typically espouse, you know, just do what you can, do as much as you can. And, you know, we have amongst ourselves acknowledged that there are some extremists in this eating culture that will like shame people for, you know, various personal choices, which is never a good thing. And it reminds me, actually, there's this movie called Scott Pilgrim versus the World. It's this Michael Cera
movie. Oh, I love that.
Oh,
I
have you
that.
Seen it?
I love the vegan part where
the vegan police.
Powers. Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
I used to be a strict vegan myself. And I remember that sort of, there were some fellow vegans that were pretty militant in their beliefs. And movie always made me laugh so much. The vegan police, because it can feel like that if you're trying to eat plant-based and there are some pretty extremist people in your community.
Well, I also like the idea that, you know, that there's this mythos surrounding veganism. So the way they portrayed that is that, like, because this guy was vegan, he had powers, you know, and that when they found out he wasn't being strict anymore, they stripped him of his powers, you know. So I thought that was It was delightful.
So everyone listening should also check out Scott Pilgrim versus the World. It's a great watch.
Yes.
Love Michael Cera.
it may not give you an insight into cults, but it's a rollicking good time.
A fun watch. Yeah. You can cleanse yourself after all of the heavy cult talk.
Yes.
So back to the heavy cult talk. Understanding that there is no distinct profile, which I think we've spoken about and we've established, in your opinion, do you think there are any commonalities amongst persons who do fall victim to cult recruitment?
Well, you know, I want to touch on something you mentioned earlier. You know, you were saying there's this myth that people who were intellectually inferior or troubled in some way, get sucked in. And we talked at length about how anyone can get sucked in, but it doesn't mean that it's not true that you are more vulnerable if you're vulnerable. People who have had troubled backgrounds, people who are survivors from some other sense, they are probably more susceptible than most because, especially, you know, if you're hurting as a result of whatever trauma you experience and suddenly you meet cult people, well, at the beginning, they use a technique called love bombing. They give you a lot of attention. They give you a lot of praise. It's to get, you know, to have a positive association in your mind between every time you see these people and the good feeling that you have. So, you know, that's to keep you coming back for as long as it takes to get you, you know, sucked in. And then, once you get sucked in, it turns into the opposite where, you know, you're constantly criticized and shamed and blah, 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 blah. But initially, when you're in a survival mode after something bad that you've come out of or that you're still experiencing and that you meet people who are showering you with what seems to be love, you know, that's very attractive. And especially not just showering you with love, but telling you that you have the answer. They find out whatever it is you've been through or are going through and say, oh, we have the answer to that. We can fix that. We can make you feel better. We can make you stop being, you know, an alcoholic or in aesthetic realism, gay or whatever, you know, quote affliction, real or imagined that you may have. And, whatever pain you may be feeling from it, you know, they have the answer for you. They have the solution. And that's very attractive, you know, to anyone who's experiencing pain, you know, I mean, you could see that how that would be attractive if you feel you have no way out, or, you know, even if you've gotten out of some bad situation, but you're carrying the pain around with you. And that's, you know, anyone who's gone through emotional pain knows that it is no different than physical pain. You know, it feels the same. It hurts, you know. I mean, that's why we have suicide. I mean, we have, you know, people who have terminal illness and are feeling physical pain, their, you know, their desire to end their life sometime is no different from people who are feeling the emotional pain. It's just too, you know, it's not, you know, people who have never been suicidal may not understand. It's not the idea that you feel like life is not worth living as much as like, God damn, this hurts. You know, I want to end the pain. And, you know, stopping your mind is the only way to stop that.
Mm-hmm.
It seems it's the only way to stop that. I'm not advocating suicide, but
right.
Anyway, so as a result, you feel hurt. Someone says they have the answer to that hurt. You're going to at least listen to what they have to say.
Absolutely. And deliberately or intuitively, these groups understand that if they can find those buttons and like find out where you're susceptible to listening to them, you know, whether or not they're well-intended, they are attuned to this method of sort of screening you. And in Scientology, they call that finding your ruin, or they just refer
yes.
to whatever place
yeah.
at which
yeah.
you're sensitive or susceptible. They call that your ruin. So,
yeah,
I mean, that sounds pretty dark, by the way.
Well, but it's so true. I mean, at least, you know, well, in their internal documents, they're being upfront about it. When you say they find your ruin, that's not something that most members are supposed to know. I mean, you know, let's be clear for your listeners that, like, that's, you know, that's what the leaders know. But, you know, rank and file members aren't supposed to have any clue that that's what's going on.
Wow. Which, I mean, and those,
what's right?
crazy. Yes. What's crazy about that is that the admins, you know, those at the very top of the Scientology like tree, like I can't speak to David Miscavige's personal beliefs, obviously, but they all seem to be believers too. And yet these are the ones with the most incriminating information about the practices of their own organization.
Oh, okay. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes and yes. The thing is that even the brainwashers are themselves brainwashed, and it's a hard thing to wrap your mind around. But basically, just like, you know, you talk to someone who's in a cult and you think that, oh, I'll just, you know, be very logical with them. The logic just bounces off of them. I mean, Steve, you know, Aston says this. He said, you know, you think you're just going to go in and reason with them. That ain't going to work. It's just not going to work. You know, they're insulated from logic. They'll rationalize anything. They'll rationalize, you know, oh, well, you give them some piece of logic, and then they'll rationalize in a contorted way around it, like all the media is all biased, you know, the media is fake news or whatever. Well, the people at the top, they do the same thing, and with all of the brainwashing they're doing of other people and the hurt they're giving, they rationalize that. Well, this, you know, it's necessary because it's in service to the truth that we know. It's mm-hmm. in service to this belief system that is the greatest thing since sliced bread. So they'll rationalize it the same way. It's, you know, all about rationalizing.
Right. And on a different scale, we all are guilty of confirmation bias every single day of our lives. And so people who are at the very top of the ladder within these cultic organizations, they're the most well-practiced at confirmation bias and thought-stopping and all of these things.
Yeah.
You know, they've been at it for a very long time. And so, unfortunately, they've gotten very good at those self-destructive methods. What is the best advice you can offer for those listening who want to protect themselves or loved ones against predatory cults?
Well, read Steve Hassan's book for sure. his books, you know, his are the gold standard. You know, if you're not into reading a whole book, at least start with, you know, my article at newyorkcult.com, How Cults Recruit. Get familiar with the process of how they do that, and then you may be able to recognize it if it's being applied to you. Yeah, I want to go back a second. You were talking about, you know, we were talking about rationalizing. Okay, so the cult I was in for years claimed to have a cure for homosexuality. Well, they still do. It's just now they no longer teach it. And I say – I put cure in quotes because, you know, I, like most people, recognize that, you know, homosexuality is just a condition. It's not a defect, and it's not amenable to change. Amenable mm-hmm. is even the wrong word there, but it's not, you know, it's just, you know, you're born with a gender, you know, you're
a
born
sexual
with
orientation,
you know, various limbs. You're born exactly, you know. So, you know, if the media ever comes calling, and I have a page on my website to kind of train reporters for how to talk to the aesthetic realists, because they obfuscate like nobody's business. You know, they'll say, "Oh, that was a long time ago. That was decades ago. You know, that we stopped that in 1990. In 1990, they stopped giving lessons on how to not be gay anymore. But they still believe that homosexuality is a result of a person's contempt for the world, and that by studying aesthetic realism, you can purge your contempt and therefore not be homosexual anymore. And you know, indeed, among their ranks are several people who went through that process in the 70s and are, quote, cured, and then quickly married off to another aesthetic realist. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, one of the things I have on my site, I was upset that I was not allowed to former member sent me a tape of a secret internal meeting in the group. Very juicy. And I wish they had let me post the audio. They did not, but they said that I could post a transcript. So it's all typed out. It's all there. And what the meeting is, it's, for lack of a better word, an inquisition of a member who had been supposedly, quote, cured of his gayness, and then quickly married off to another cult member, and then found to still be cruising for gay sex. The cult made a movie, a little short film about, you know, all their success stories, and they had to quickly hurriedly edit him out of that. And so you might think that the meeting was going to be, oh, well, you've fallen off the wagon. How can we help you? How can we lead you back to truth, beauty, and light? It wasn't. Yeah, they raked the poor guy and his wife over the coals. She was raked over the coals because she didn't report on her husband soon enough.
Oh.
She did like the next day, but it wasn't like she didn't immediately call, pick up the phone like you would dial 911 if someone had been shot. And so
it's just
anyway,
this chastisement punishment.
Oh yeah, pretty much. But so anyway, I have a very bad habit of not getting to the point. So let me try to do that at long last. So. You would think that all these people might realize, yeah, this guy has never really changed from homosexuality. It's very clear. But no, they have to rationalize it because they can't say that aesthetic realism failed, right? So they're all amongst themselves, they're all saying, he really changed, but he just wants to hurt aesthetic realism and Eli Segal. So this is his way of getting – he wants to feel superior to them. He doesn't want to feel that he could learn anything from them. So he's having sex with men
as a personal vendetta against the group.
Exactly. You can read that in the transcript. So
wow.
There again, I said my own personal definition of brainwash is the inability to see what's obvious to everybody else. There you go.
Wow. Oh my gosh, that's so sad. Oh, those poor people.
Yeah.
You know, it's you know, I don't know how similar or different the aesthetic realism approach is to homosexuality than conversion camps in some extremist Christian organizations.
Oh, yeah, and South Park really did a number on them, and kudos to them for that.
Aesthetic realists or conversion camps?
No, not aesthetic real specifically, but the Christian gay change camps.
Oh, got it. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I haven't seen that one yet.
You will want to. They also did separately. They did they did one on cults in general, where you know, Cartman. I'm having a hard time. It's taxing my memory, but Cartman gets sucked in, and the other guys try to get him out, and then one of the other kids gets sucked in. So yeah, they have skewered cults in general and conversion therapy camps specifically. So you know, kudos to them for doing that. They did it, and they did a good job. It's, you know, they bring humor to a difficult subject.
Absolutely. They do great work. And I think one of the best methods of informing the public is through humor. I really do.
Yeah.
If you can find a way to tackle a very thorny subject in a lighthearted way, then in which people are not going to feel uncomfortable or get their heckles up and they're ready to like listen and receive this material because they're receiving it in an entertaining way. And that's a tall order. And I think that they do a really, really great job. And I think they've serviced a lot of people just in their information giving.
And they would like the way you phrase that. You know, it's funny, you know, for a long time, you know, 13 years ago, they skewered Al Gore when they were attacking the idea of climate change, and they portrayed him as this, you know, misguided idiot. And so I liked a lot of the stuff they did on South Park, but I always had a little pit in my stomach because of that. But then I don't know if you knew that, you know, the in the last season, they basically in an episode, they admitted he was right and they apologized to him. and so it's like, oh, wow, I can like South Park 100% now. So that's,
That's cool that they were able to like step up and own something from, way back.
Well, especially, and kudos to them, for it's hard to anyone to admit a mistake. But you staked out a position, it's embarrassing to have to backtrack, but so kudos to them again for doing so.
Yeah. It also speaks to their open-mindedness that they were willing to like review their own opinions about things, their own stated opinions about things.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. There's this myth that, liberals acknowledge climate change and conservatives don't, because, if you look at the polls, a majority of Republicans acknowledge climate change. Mm-hmm. It's the extremists on that side who don't, like that, idiot legislator from, Oklahoma City who brings a snowball onto the floor of Congress and says that's proof that no global warming, as though he's made some sort of point. Them and, his followers, they're on the extreme. But even most Republicans acknowledge climate change. So it's not necessarily a left and right thing. But that aside, there's this concept that, you may have heard these say, like, if you're not a liberal in your 20s, you have no heart. And if you're not a conservative in your 50s, you have no brain. Well, I disagree with that. I'm in my 50s and I'm still squarely liberal. But it's interesting for if you consider climate change to be, a left and right kind of thing, you can see that, Matt and Trey have gone in the opposite direction as they get older. So then again, my personal belief is that science is not a liberal or conservative concept. It's just, that's the reality of the world that we live in.
I agree. I think that it's important we all strive to stop looking at everything through the lens of partisanship, because we're becoming so polarized in this country that we're unable to take stances based on nothing but logic. It's almost as though everything is leaning one way or another, and that's a dangerous place to be.
Yes. Concur.
So anyway, that was a pleasant tangent. I think it was an important one, though.
I love tangents.
Me too.
My middle name.
I'm about to ask you how I can direct my listeners to your works. But before I do, was there anything else that you wanted to address or make sure we discuss before we sort of wind down?
It's not important, but I'm going to say it anyway. I was talking about my friend. He has the former vegan website. And one of the slogans he has is, "Love the vegan, hate the veganism." And it's funny because and I haven't told him this yet, but I kind of feel the opposite. I dislike the extremist vegans, but veganism, I think it's good for the environment, it's good for health, it's good for a lot of reasons. So
I agree with that entirely. I think if you have an agenda against veganism, you've probably just come across some pretty extremist vegans, and they've colored your thinking about lifestyle.
My kids were vegan, and I think one of the main reasons he stopped is that this guy who worked for me was an extremist, nut job vegan, and they didn't want to be in his camp. They didn't want to be associated with him or that kind of person. And it could backfire.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah. It can. I remember being vegan myself, like strict vegan. And if you encountered another vegan, it was almost like this challenge seemed to happen. No, I always felt like I was on the defensive.
How vegan are you?
But I felt like I was on the defensive against everyone, because if someone found out I was vegan and they're not vegan, they could be aggressive with me. Like, why? Why are you doing this? Yeah. Like, tell me why. Yeah. Tell me, is it health? Is it environment? Is it whatever? And like, sometimes I don't want to talk about it. Like, I want to talk. You know what I mean? Like, that was my business. Like, I wouldn't ask someone else why they're eating the way they're eating. But I would. Yeah. There were also times when I would meet a fellow vegan and they'd be like, "Oh, really? Well, what kind of bread is that in that tomato sandwich you've got there?"
Yeah.
Because you understand this. And there was almost like they would try to catch me out in things that I was trying to be so conscientious, but I just felt like I was on the defensive with everybody. And that's one of the reasons that I decided to like dial back a little bit. Like I said, I still try to eat plant-based, but I no longer call myself a vegan. I don't eat strict vegan anymore. And, Yeah, there's a weird social component to the whole thing.
Oh, yeah. Yes. That's why I say that, you know, as a vegan with cult experience, the things I like best on my friend's website are when I think he's on Shake Your Ground when he's, you know, going over, you know, health issues or certain environmental issues. Those are debatable. You know, some maybe have merit, maybe not. You know, he's on the strongest ground when he goes after the cult aspects of veganism, because he's absolutely right, you know. And, you know, I always like to say on my site that my strongest evidence against the aesthetic realists is not what I say. It's not what the other X members say. It's what the aesthetic realists themselves say. I have that whole section, AR in their own words. You know, they used to buy full page ads in the New York Times and other newspapers espousing various ridiculous things. So there's that. There's the secret internal meeting that I mentioned. You know, there's their books. There's you know, a lot of evidence for the things that they say themselves.
And I'm really curious to read more about aesthetic realism now, because I've done a little bit of research into cults and this and you know, a lot of these topics, and I've heard of commercial cults and political cults and religious cults, and I haven't heard anything described as a philosophical cult before.
Oh yeah, there are lots of them. I mean, even Zendik was a philosophical cult. Scientology is kind of on the border between religion and, you know, they call it the Church of Scientology, so there's that.
Right. I mean, it's pretty philosophical, especially in the elementary stages, but my understanding is once you reach a certain point in the teachings.
Got a foot in both worlds.
Right.
You know, look into, you know, you may have come across someone who was part of the Westboro Baptist Church, you know, the extremist, you know, anti-gay, you know, religious cult. There was someone who was their, she was their media, she was like their spokesperson, and now she's out and, you know, talking about her experience. And, you know, it's not all that different from people who were in non-religious cults, you know?
Right.
Cults are similar than people realize.
Right. There are universal patterns.
Yes.
Yes. So, Michael, this has been an illuminating conversation. I want to thank you for it. If people want to learn more about you and your outreach against aesthetic realism and cults in general, how can they do that?
NewYorkCult.com.
NewYorkCult.com. Thank you.
Yes.
On next week's episode, we learn about Leon Festinger's theory of cognitive dissonance, how it can be used as a tool to establish mind control. And Lola Adams officially joins the temple. See you Wednesday.